WBR Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And joining me on the Commons today is Ken Chadwick. Ken is principal of the firm Chadwick, Washington, Olters, Moriarty, and Lynn in the Washington, D.C. area. He's also past chair of the Washington Metropolitan Chapter of CAI, the Virginia Chapter of CAI, chair of the National Community Associations Institute and of their associate and of their Legislative Action Committee, past president of CAI's Research Foundation, and a member of the College of Community Association Lawyers. Ken presented a session at the law seminar last February titled Association Regulation versus Owner Rights Inside the Home, and he very kindly agreed to join us on the Commons today to talk about it. Ken, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Boy, what a list of accomplishments, and I only did just a few of them. There's a lot more. You've been busy, huh?
I have been. Thank you.
Well, I'm especially grateful that you did take time out of your very busy schedule to come and join us and talk to us about your paper that you gave. That's kind of a touchy subject, isn't it? I mean, where do the rights of the homeowner start and begin vis-a-vis the... I guess the rights of the association.
Well, I think it's always a question of remembering that, in general, the common rule is that in America, your house is your castle, as it comes down throughout the common law traditions. What we have is a change, though, in the common law tradition, both by statute and also by the recorded documents recorded against all of the properties in these community associations. And when I'm using the term community association, I'm using the term that defines a property where there is a recorded declaration, either of condominium or a declaration of covenants, conditions, and restrictions, which generally is found in a homeowners association. And so you have inroads, if you will, into that theory of your home is your castle based upon whatever kind of agreement you take when you take your deed to your property in one of those community associations. So it is really, in many cases, important for the homeowners or unit owners in a condominium association to look carefully over those documents, because there are some reservation of the normally thought of rights in your home that are going to be contained in those documents.
So basically you're saying everyone who lives in an association is subject to that, or?
Well, obviously it depends upon the recorded documents of the association and how specific they are, and just how much authority is given to the association to infringe upon the rights of the homeowners, if you will. The general theory is that unless it's specifically stated, or unless there is a rule authority, your home still is your castle, to the extent that it's not going to infringe upon somebody else's right to the free use and enjoyment of their adjacent property or nearby property, and in addition, the association may have certain rights to protect that are common to all, such as the interest in the common areas or the common elements that might be infringed upon by a homeowner.
Could you give us some examples of something like that?
Well, in today's today's day and age, we're seeing more and more of issues of behavior come into play, especially in condominium associations, where you either have noise violations or health or safety concerns that may arise, either as a result of infestation of roaches or other pests, mice, rats, that type of thing, where a homeowner has decided to be a collector of various and sundry items that clog his unit and basically serve as a home for some of those pets. And if you're the homeowner residing next to that unit owner, you want the association to take care of it. Under those circumstances, there is some case law out there that indicates that an association may have the right to go in to a unit to deal with the pest issue. He may or may not, depending upon the documents, have the ability to clean out the unit, but the health department might have something to say about that as well. So even in this day and age, it's not only the association that has rights in those individual units or homes. It may be a local jurisdiction's health department, police department, fire department that has the same sort of concerns that the association might have with regard to that particular unit.
So, but basically what you're talking about is an attached unit. I mean, if you were living in a single-family home and you had rodents, that, you know, that probably wouldn't be an excuse or a reason for anyone else to come in and inspect your property.
Right.
Other than maybe the local authorities.
Right. Were your conduct in a more traditional community association affects the use of the property, the free use and enjoyment of the property of others, then you may in some cases be crossing the line into an area where the association would have certain rights to correct or take action against you for creating a situation which impacts the right of use and enjoyment of the property by others.
One of the quotes that I'm going to read from the paper that you presented is, there is a natural tension when an association is attempting to enforce behavior, conduct, or activity on the lots or in the units. Behavior. What kind of, I mean, I can understand noise, but the noise, again, that would be an attack, or it could be anything, but that would be something that would be sort of under the jurisdiction of the local authorities. But what would, why would an association want to come inside?
Well, the association in some cases might not have any other choice but to go inside, because under many sets of documents, there are provisions which require the association to enforce the restrictive covenants in the under the documents. And so if there are restrictions against, such as noise violation or creating a nuisance or a hazard or a risk of that involves the risk of health or safety of others within the community, there may be an affirmative obligation on the part of the association to actually go into that unit to rectify the problem.
So we're talking about noise. Somebody comes in and says, hey, your TV's on too loud. I can hear it in my unit.
Noise is a real tricky issue in any association, and obviously there oftentimes needs to be corroboration of the evidence. There needs to be systematic review of the noise created. There may have to be some professional attempts to get noise levels heard. It's not as you try to take it as much out of the subjective and put it into the objective as possible, but in many ways it's the same sort of thing where the association, or excuse me, where a local police officer comes by because of a noise complaint in a unit or a home and ask them to turn down the stereo or turn down the other implement that's making the noise. So the association serves as a responsible party to try to deal with that, and oftentimes I think they really need to take the neighborly approach, which is to try to deal with it first in a less formal situation, more neighbor-to-neighbor kind of thing. Unfortunately, I think personally that oftentimes neighbors ought to try to do that as well, instead of automatically relying on the association to do their work for them.
Oh, I agree.
Next door neighbors in private communities that are not community associations obviously from time to time have to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's good for neighbors to let each other know. But then when you get into a situation where there is a chronic problem in the association with an individual who really doesn't care about what his neighbors or anyone else thinks about the generation of noise at any time of the day or night, then you get into an issue that the association may have to insert themselves into. And I don't think associations necessarily want to insert themselves all the time, but are called upon by the documents or part of their responsibility under the association's articles or bylaws to do that.
What's the silliest thing you've ever seen? I really cannot think of anything. I mean, if the TV's on too loud and, you know, you go next door and you say, hey, I'm trying to sleep, or, you know, you want to cut it down. And I've had to do that.
Mm.
And it's not been an issue. They sort of apologize and say, we're sorry, we didn't realize that it was that loud or it was that late, and it's not a problem.
Mm.
They take care of it.
Where you run into this oftentimes is where there is a difference in lifestyles, especially as it relates to work schedules. You may have one unit owner below who is on a normal 9-to-5 kind of schedule and comes home, wants to go to bed around 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. upstairs neighbor, and this was a situation in one of the communities we represented several years ago, where the upstairs neighbors had more of a graveyard shift. Would come in all full of life. Actually, he had a, I think it was like from a 5 till midnight shift, and he'd come in around midnight, and he'd be ready to go to town, and he'd either have parties, or he was also a weightlifter, and had weights in his unit that he would use, freestanding weights, and
he'd drop them, right?
He'd drop them from time to time in the middle of the night, but serving as an all-purpose alarm clock for the neighbor downstairs, who eventually didn't necessarily appreciate what was going on. And the neighbor there had really done what he could. There were a series of notes and minutes that he took regarding the incidents. He also indicated in his minutes and his reflections that he had gone up to the neighbor asking for some sort of a ability for them to curtail their activity, especially after midnight, and then had also routinely, after having attempted the voluntary approach, called the police, and there were a series of police reports, and all that kind of stuff led to his coming to the association and saying, here's a list of the chronic problem that I'm dealing with and I'm still dealing with, and the association had recording devices installed in his unit to measure...
You're kidding.
Nope.
They went into the unit and installed recording?
They installed in his unit audio measuring devices to determine the level of the noise, and the level of the noise was in excess of what was allowed by local county standards. So after a certain time. So there not only did we have the documents, because this was cause for creating a nuisance, but we also had a county ordinance that we could rely on as additional support to indicate that what the homeowner above was doing was creating a nuisance.
But Ken, shouldn't the county be enforcing its own ordinances? I mean, don't we pay taxes for that sort of thing?
That's an excellent question, but I'm afraid that our counties are stretched rather thin, especially as you are aware in Virginia, where budgets are tight throughout the local government and the state levels. And they do not have the manpower nor the wherewithal to continually take on these individual complaints, especially when you consider either a police or fire department or someplace like that where they've got other more important, quote-unquote, pressing problems that may require or may pose more of a significant risk to health, safety, or welfare of individuals than a situation involving a noise complaint. So generally speaking, while it is within the province of a community or locality to enforce these types of things, they generally don't have the time, the energy, or the money to do it.
You know, talking about money, and I really don't want to get too far off track, but you've just kind of hit upon one of my favorite pet peeves here, and that is the county. in Fairfax County is a very wealthy county. And they seem to have the money to keep building more and more local government centers. I mean, there's the brand new one in Braddock District, and a mile and a half down the road, there's the brand new one in Springfield. Not to mention the Taj Mahal and B1 and B2 and all these other government centers that they keep building all over the place. Where do they come up with that money from?
the bottom line is, I think, that we're fortunate to live in Fairfax County. I can't talk to their budgetary or their monetary stream of income, but I will say that in many cases we've been very fortunate to have some of the people in Fairfax County that we do have to deal with some of these issues, or at least assist and give us guidance. And as far as other localities, I am happy to practice in Fairfax County anytime, given the nature of the local government and their support for many of the issues and their homeowner members in the community as well.
Now, there's some wonderful people in Fairfax County itself. I'm not going off that. But I'm talking about the tendency there seems to be today that to accept the fact that the county doesn't really have any money and the county is just dying of poverty, yet I see them spending it on all sorts of, in my opinion, frivolous things. I mean, there's really no need for a lot of the money that they're spending.
Right. Much in the way that Board of directors has to make decisions in a community association. The locality also has to make decisions as to where their funds and resources are going to be put, and they determine their priorities. And I would say that oftentimes these types of issues take a low priority, and you're not going to see any type of major funding going into the county enforcing anything unless it really poses a significant risk to safety or health concerns. And I think really when you look at it, those are the types of things that we really do want the locality to respond to. And many of the rights that we're talking about, especially the noise or the creation of a nuisance, oftentimes can also be enforced through private rights, which the courts will allow you to enforce. So there's alternate methods of enforcing it. So not only do they make priority decisions based upon the risks involved, but also whether or not there's any alternatives that an individual or a community or a neighborhood would have to pursue action against the individual creating the problem.
What's the silliest, I'm going to go back to what we're talking about, but what's the absolute silliest incident that you've run across? And I'm sure you've run across a number of them. How many associations do you represent?
Well, we represent several hundred.
Several hundred. So you must have heard some real doozies in terms of some of the stuff that people get into. What's the silliest one that required an association to actually enter into a home, a private space?
Well, I don't know whether it's the silliest, but one of the the more egregious situations that we ran across was a situation where a unit owner for years and years and years collected or saved newspapers and other printed documents within the context of his association condominium unit so that when it got to the point where we got involved, the association got involved, there was a great concern about the health and safety of the interior of the unit because their pests of various natures seemed to be coming out of that unit without any restriction. And eventually the health, we gained access under the Condominium Act's right of access and the association's ability to access condominium units with reasonable notice, and got into the unit for the purposes of identifying where the source of the problem was. Well, we realized that when we went to the unit, where the source of the problem was immediately, because we couldn't even get the door opened fully to get into the unit. The unit was stacked with papers, trash, all sorts of different items, and this was that was an objective viewpoint. That was not being subjective. There was stuff all over the place, stacked from floor to ceiling, that this person had simply saved routinely over the course of years. And there were little passageways through the unit that you could get to a room, but as far as being able to sit anyplace or to move about freely within the unit, that was an impossibility. You couldn't get more than one person abreast in the unit in these little passageways between the junk. And it was a real problem, and it was a real problem in terms of the unit owner, too, because I don't think the unit owner really knew what he or she was doing under the circumstances.
So this was probably somebody who, what I understand you saying is this was somebody who needed maybe some psychiatric counseling or something?
There are some times that we run into that situation where the individual may in fact need some sort of mental health assistance or some sort of counseling of one sort or another. It may be a person who is young. It may be a person who has reached more mature age.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with all sorts of issues, and when you're dealing, especially, this is more so in a condominium setting, when you're dealing with a condominium, you're dealing with people who live much more closely with one another, especially when we're talking either a garden style or a high-rise condominium association. And their behavior internal to the unit can significantly impact not only other unit owners, but also the cost associated with maintaining or repairing the condominium itself.
What did you do in a situation like that? I mean,
Well, once we had access, we eventually were able to work first with the locality to, in this case, you can get somebody committed for psychiatric evaluation or mental health purposes, and we were able to do that in that situation. And you then you also have to go into court to get a court order to allow you to do anything else that you need to do on the inside of the unit. You need to be careful there because obviously the you don't want to overstep what the association's responsibilities are. And our main concern was dealing with the pest problem that was emanating from the unit. So we were able to get in there and do a spray and clean up the trash. The stacks remained until the fire department in that situation got involved and caused the unit to be, in essence, condemned because it was a fire hazard as well. So eventually the unit had to be cleaned out of all of the trash that had been collected over the years.
Well, this sounds a bit like the Cunningham case out of California, except that you're talking about getting someone committed here. I mean, is that within the purview of the association?
Well, you work with the locality that you're in, whether it's D.C., Maryland, or Virginia. There are different commitment laws and involuntary and voluntary commitment procedures in each of the jurisdictions that you would then work under to get this person, if necessary, committed, or get the locality. In this case, the locality also got involved and found this person to be a potential hazard to themselves, and that was enough for the purposes of determining that this person at least needed temporary evaluation.
That's a little scary. But this goes back, I mean, this does remind me a little bit of the Cunningham case where the association went in. In that case, though, the fire marshal did not find it to be a hazard.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the board went in and decided to go through closets and clothes and reading material and all kinds of wonderful things there, eh?
Yeah, I believe that's the case, that the court was not too pleased with the Unit Owners Association for making certain comments about what they found in the unit and what they wanted the individual to do with regard to keeping his unit more clean and even went to the extent of commenting on to some extent on the reading material that the person had in his unit.
Well, I interviewed the attorney who represented Cunningham about 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she said they put the board president on the stand and they questioned him about what constituted normal reading material. And he sat there and started telling him what he thought was normal reading material.
Yeah, and I think there that unfortunately the focus, for whatever reason, of the individuals got off of what it was that the purpose of the association was in the context of that situation versus what their own personal beliefs might have been.
Well, again, the fire marshal decided there was not a fire hazard,
mm-hmm.
and the board decided the fire marshal really didn't know what he was talking about. So they went ahead with their lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, sometimes you do that. As an attorney, you sometimes do that after advising your clients of what the circumstances are, and your client may determine that they, regardless of what your position might be in counseling them, that they want to pursue this regardless, and that may have been the case in that situation, especially after. I couldn't imagine after a fire marshal in a locality didn't find the problem of such an extent that he didn't condemn it or find it to be a fire hazard that the association went forward, or that in that case that the attorney would have said, oh, we got a great case here, let's just run rampant with it and go forward.
Well, okay, we're going to take a little detour here. You keep taking me down these straight paths here, Ken. As an attorney, I mean, if you were the attorney representing the association there, that doesn't help your reputation a whole lot if you go after them for something like that, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And
how'd you handle it?
There are two issues there. One that all boards need to take into consideration when they're dealing with any situation, and that's credibility. Credibility both in terms of their own community, but also credibility should they take the stand and how it is that they're going to be perceived by the court in which they're proceeding under the case. credibility is very, very important. And that's why you generally tend to want to stay away from cases that are solely being taken on the basis of principle instead of logic. The other thing is, as an attorney for associations, it's very important, I think, to, you know, advise the client, make sure the client has all of the information so they can make a very fully informed decision. But subsequently, it may become incumbent upon the attorney to make sure that the client understands by giving them something in writing. But even then, clients from time to time decide that despite the position that the attorney has given them and taken with regard to their recommendations, that they still think that it's strong enough of a situation to pursue. And then the attorney is in somewhat of a dilemma because he's given an opinion that he or she may not feel that this case is the appropriate one to go forward on, but he's also got an ethical duty to represent his client in a manner that's in the client's best interest as the client perceives it. And so the client then dictates what happens, and the association's attorney either has to decide, is this one that I give up and go forward on, or do I maintain my position and simply resign from being attorney for this client? And that's something that we're putting in oftentimes over the course of representing community associations.
So that is a choice you make. You have to resign as the association.
As legal counsel for the association.
Because you don't want to go forward with that. Have you ever been in that position?
Fortunately, most of my clients have not taken positions when it comes to litigation contrary to our position. So I've not been put in that position. I have been put in positions where the client wanted me to render an opinion different than the one that I did. And in that case, in one case where we rendered an opinion and it was contrary to what a majority on the board wanted, we eventually were terminated with that client. But then, lo and behold, the client, after they got another counsel in to say that our opinion was wrong and that this new counsel's opinion was right, someone challenged them in the local jurisdiction's courthouse, and lo and behold, the court quoted our opinion, indicating that we were the correct attorney in this case in rendering that opinion, and about 6 months later, the client was back in the fold. So you maintain your ethical position at all times in representing these associations, because one of the things that you learn early on is that boards change, and as long as you're giving the correct and in your best judgment the right opinion, then there's nothing that you can be faulted on.
So I guess the moral of the story is don't stoop to areas that you really don't want to go into, really.
It's kind of like the expression that went on from Spike Lee several years ago, do the right thing. And that's in representing these community associations, that's what you try to do. Do the right thing for the community and the association that you're representing under the law.
And I imagine sometimes it must be pretty hard, because you get people who have personal agendas or who are really hell-bent on going one way, and they're in a position to... I guess being on the board, they're in a position to push their views forward.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
so,
true.
And so you're stuck in the middle. You say, hey, wait a minute.
Sometimes you are stuck in the middle, and sometimes there are tough decisions that we as attorneys have to make.
I'm sure there are. You're on the Commons. We're talking to Ken Chadwick today. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more from Ken.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. On the Commons with me today is Ken Chadwick, and Ken's an attorney and in the Northern Virginia, actually the Washington metropolitan area. I think you practice in Maryland and D.C. as well, right, Ken?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So he's been a busy man, and we've been trying to get a hold of. Actually, I've been trying to get Ken on the show for a long time, and I just told him off the air that here's an indication, because the first time I called him and invited him to come on, we just couldn't get the dates right, and he was always busy on a Saturday. And so I found something on CAI's message board that I printed, and the date here is April 19th. So that's how long I've been trying to get Ken on here. So I'm really glad you're on here finally,
Ken. Oh, really glad to be here.
This one had to do, and I talked to you very briefly off the air here, about the garage parking and a right of entry to inspect. And somebody wrote in and said that their association consisted of townhomes and single-family homes, and every unit had two-car garages, and they wanted to know why people were parking outside on the driveway instead of in the garage. And they wanted to write, and they had a model here of a proposed rule that they wanted to adopt that would give them the right to go in and inspect the inside of the garage to make sure that they weren't storing stuff in there and had adequate space to park their cars in there. You want to comment on that one?
Well, the issue of garages and parking within community associations, there's an old standard saying that the parking pets and policies are the biggest bane of most community associations' existence, and parking is one of the major three issues, especially, and where I'd like to start out with this is to go back to the references that we've talked about in terms of the counties or the localities, cities, towns, where these community associations first take form on paper. And what in those local jurisdictions in their zoning or planning offices, what they do is they say, well, we need to have 1.7 or we need to have 1.9 or some sort of percentage of parking spots per unit within the context of the community. And when they're putting this on paper, the developer says, well, that's good. This is in order to achieve that, I'm going to put one of the parking spots or two of the parking spots on an individually owned lot. And then I will create within the common areas the rest of the parking spots that I need. But obviously if the parking spot on the individual lot is not counted, there are not enough parking spots on the common area to deal with either parking within the community or with the zoning requirement of 1.7, 1.8 parking spots per unit. Well, that's great as far as the developer is concerned, counting those, but when it comes time for the actual transition from developer control to unit owner control, those garages on private property are now privately owned on private lots. And the association, unless there's something in the recorded documents, don't have the ability to mandate necessarily that parking of those lot owners who own a garage townhome must be in their own parking garage or on their pad in front of their home. And what we run into, and there have been a couple cases in Fairfax and Loudoun County to this end, what has happened in some of these communities where you have garage and non-garage townhomes, there has been a conflict that has been raised on the parking issue because the boards, in order to alleviate the problem on common areas, say, look, you townhome garage owners should be parking in your garages, so therefore we'll assign two parking spots on the common areas to non-garage homeowners and either one or none to you as garage homeowners. And that creates an inequity in the rights on the common elements. With regard to the easements that are given to all unit owners to use those on an equal basis. And so the courts in the three cases that I'm aware of in Northern Virginia, both in Fairfax and Loudoun County, have indicated that the easement rights of all owners in the common areas trumps the parking issue, and all owners have the same right of use in those common areas unless it's expressly set forth in the documents that the board can disparately treat garage townhomes from non-garage townhomes. And it's been a real thorn in the side of practitioners for many years, because obviously those garages should be used for parking purposes, but over time what happens is that becomes a playroom, a family room, some other sort of room other than a garage as a result of remodeling or modifications that are made to the home, and it's an additional living area. And I imagine that the woman who wanted to create the rule to allow them to inspect inside of the garage to determine what use was being that garage was being put to probably was in a garage town, non-garage town home association where they were having parking problems and wanted to require that the homeowners who have garages on their lots use them for parking their cars.
Well, she even wanted to fine people who wouldn't permit inspections.
I'm sorry, say that again?
She wanted to fine people who would not permit inspections.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of, I guess I personally don't really understand that mentality at all. But we did talk about, and I can't think of the name of the case, Lawrence McClafferty was the attorney who litigated, and he did come on the show, and he did talk about the cases that he litigated where the garage versus the non-garage,
mm-hmm.
and allocating the spaces. But I'm talking about, I mean, this thread seems to tie in more with the paper that you presented on where the association regulations sort of end and private property rights begin.
Right, and it really gets into a question of what is the association's interest in going on the property, and is there a legitimate basis for them to go on that property to firm up an interest that they have to protect under the covenants or on the common areas or elements of the association.
I guess one thing that we really need to point out is that absent any specific language in the governing documents, the board cannot adopt rules giving them permission to come in and inspect and then fine you if you don't let them inspect you,
mm-hmm.
inspect you, the interior of your property.
Right. Generally speaking, that's accurate. Especially when you deal with the inside of a unit or other portion of a privately owned entity, unless there's some provision, either statutorily or under the documents, under the Condominium Act in Virginia, there is an express authority to right of access under certain circumstances and with certain notice to gain access to a unit to deal with issues that you, as the condominium association, have internal to the unit. There may be things, common elements that are within the context of the unit that you may have to take care of, or that you may have maintenance, repair, and replacement responsibility on things either that are common elements or part of the unit in the unit that you have to gain access in order to maintain, repair, or replace. But otherwise, you're absolutely right. The authority should really be set forth in the express written documents that control the association, and adopting a rule that gives you authority into a unit is something that is, unless there's some other provision in the documents that gives you that authority, you're going to be hard-pressed to support that in the law and before a court.
Yeah, but you're talking about condominiums, and this does not necessarily mean all units. I mean, a condominium I can understand because the owner actually only owns airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And the association is responsible for the structure. And that's a whole different...
Well, actually, I can take you out to places out in western Fairfax and Loudoun County where the condominium unit is the entire structure, and the only common elements are the green grass that grows outside. So the form of ownership, or actually the type of ownership, condominium or townhome, private townhome or private single-family home concept is one thing, but when you're looking at the actual structure of the house, sometimes it can be a condominium without you even knowing it, and you own the whole thing as a unit.
Okay. Okay, so this must be a fairly relatively new design.
Yeah, well, it's a new concept in the sense that what developers oftentimes will do in order to use the property without having to subdivide it, they will create a condominium form of ownership that the structure itself resembles a townhome community, but because they didn't want to have to go through the formal subdivision process, they created a condominium, which is preempted from the application of those subdivision ordinances, and then create the similar style of responsibilities in that townhome structure so that the unit is actually the entire structure, including the outside, so that then, just as in a townhome subdivision, in this condominium townhome, the unit owner has the responsibility for maintaining the exterior of their home just like they would in a townhome situation.
One of the pluses, I guess, for having a condominium that often is cited is the fact that you don't have to do any maintenance on it. So that kind of takes away from that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Thus, it becomes paramount that you really, really do read the documents of the association that you're purchasing into, because you may be buying more than you really thought. There are a number of communities down in the central area of Virginia, down in the Richmond area, the Williamsburg area, and that area, where a townhome set of documents actually was created that puts the onus for the exterior maintenance on the association, even though it's a single-family townhome community. So
yeah,
there are lots of different ways to split the baby and get to the same result, whether it's a condominium or townhome, depending upon how you draft those documents. So you may be buying into a townhome association where you think you're the king of your castle, both on the interior and the exterior with regard to maintenance, repair, and replacement, only to come to find out that you're not, and therefore may have to read those documents a little bit more carefully next time you buy.
Well, you know, the earlier one you were talking about, it kind of sounds like the developers just circumventing, doing some paperwork, trying to get away from having to comply with the subdivision ordinances, right?
Well, gee, Sue, I would never say that. As a practicing attorney from whom I get these associations after they're developed, because I want those developers to keep developing them so that we can continue to get more business. But I think that's to some extent accurate, that there are times when some of these ordinances or some of these subdivisions are ordinances are avoided in order either to get less paperwork to have to do and or to be able to develop more densely on the property itself.
Well, that's this new urbanism, I think, and this kind of goes back a little bit to, you know, some of the parking issues.
Correct.
Where there, you know, there are no streets because the streets are very narrow, and there, for all practical purposes, no driveway.
Mm-hmm.
And one parking space is, or there's a single garage, and the other parking space has got to be the driveway, and the driveway is not long enough for a car.
Mm-hmm.
And you have them sort of hanging out.
In the middle of the sidewalk or in the middle of the street?
In the middle of the, yeah. They're just covering the entire sidewalk because they're just not built properly. So anyway, we were talking about the local government, you know, Fairfax County.
Mm-hmm.
And they're approving this, right?
Sometimes they are.
Sometimes they are. And that just... The UKIOWA, the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act. I guess you had... Did you talk in your paper about a 1994 amendment that relates, that discusses the use or behavior inside the residential unit?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, unless otherwise permitted by the declaration or this act, an association may adopt rules and regulations that affect the use of or behavior in units that may be used for residential purposes only to, 1, prevent any use of a unit which violates the declaration. And, you know, I kind of wanted to touch a little bit on that, because what happens when you have some really archaic, outdated provisions in the governing documents? And one of the ones that I'm thinking of is, you know, you cannot conduct a business from your home.
Well, there you have, that is an interesting issue that comes up oftentimes, not so much in, under the context of the quote-unquote covenant that you've just mentioned, but people come up with the idea that when you have either a residential-only provision or a single family, that, that the community is meant to be a single family home community, that that those two provisions necessarily, by the use of those words, preclude any sort of business use. And I think the, in many cases, the change in our culture in terms of working at home, in many cases, or telecommuting, or, or doing part-time things out of the home, as well as the practical applications that the courts, in a lot of the jurisdictions have come to, have kind of obviated that kind of interpretation of that, of those definitions. So that, in those communities where they have a single family home, for single family home purposes only, what the courts oftentimes will do is say, well, that simply means the type of dwelling, not any relationship whatsoever to either that it has to be a single family within that or that it's restricted from non-business purposes. They do the same thing with the residential because what they say is that part of being a residential entity also entails the potential that as a residential entity there will be some business purposes to which from time to time the home will be used, especially as our culture changes and telecommunicating and internet stuff becomes more and more of an option for communities and for individuals within communities. So what they look at then, the courts, is whether or not what is being done within the community adversely impacts either the goes against any other document provision in the covenants, or alternatively adversely impacts upon the use of the common elements or the common areas, either through traffic or through safety issues. And whether or not the use that's being put has minimal effect on the common elements and the common areas in a community really makes a difference these days. So the courts are taking a very practical approach to that issue, and regardless of what type of documents you have and what the provision is, you also have to look to what residential use is under your zoning ordinance, because the courts will oftentimes go to how the property was zoned and whether or not these are accessory uses in the property that might be allowed under zoning and therefore might be allowed under the residential purpose of a covenant.
Yeah, but you'd still have to go to court, and from what I'm understanding you to say, right?
Sometimes you do, and sometimes if you've got counsel that is up to speed on these types of issues, they'll give the boards the understanding that you have to look very carefully at what's being done and what you can tie that use of the property for business purposes to, and whether or not a court is more likely to say what that purpose is falls under what the property is zoned as, and we think that as a result of that, your residential use, as stated in your covenants, conforms to our zoning, which then conforms to allowing that as an accessory use under the way the property is zoned.
I mean, I can think of a number of things that have been in documents for years and years and years, and in hindsight, you sort of see that they just outlive their usefulness. You know, some communities where you have a certain color scheme, and you drive through there, and it sort of smacks of the 70s. You know, it's like walking into a kitchen and seeing that dreaded avocado stove. Or the gold shag carpet all over the place.
Well, how do you know the developer didn't want the 70s motif to continue on for the ages?
I know.
I mean, at some point, that community may be subject to being declared a historical landmark.
But you know what I'm talking about. Also with trucks, I mean, you know, you cannot have vehicles that have a gross weight over so many, however many, and I have no idea how much vehicles weigh. But, you know, everybody drives a van nowadays.
Right.
And that exceeds
it. Or a pickup truck.
Or a pickup truck, exactly. And I could understand back when, you know, initially when these things were initially conceived, you know, saying, well, we really don't want these old junky trucks sitting around, but that's not the case anymore. Or, you know, brown or avocado or gold or, you know, whatever the other wonderful 70s and 60s colors were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just don't seem to work, but yet the governing documents say you've got to have them.
Right. And the difficult part of that situation is that as long as they are of record, i.e., that they are on the books in land records against all of the properties, unless there's an alternative method, which there usually is not, in terms of the documents to interpret or supplement the documents by a board interpretation, the boards are going to be tasked with the responsibility of enforcing that. And to the extent that they don't enforce that, then on any other case where they're trying to enforce another provision, the defendants in those cases are going to point back to that one provision that they're not enforcing because they feel there's been a change, and they're going to say, see, Your Honor, we're in court now, and the association is being arbitrary and capricious in their selective enforcement of the covenants because while they have that no pickup truck in the community covenant, they're not enforcing that any longer, and yet they're enforcing this one against me. We think that's unfair. And the courts, especially, for instance, in Virginia, where we still have the bifurcated court system that sits at law or in equity, the courts are going to be looking at the fairness of the covenant and the enforcement by the association and are going to weigh and balance the equities and the inequities in the situation. And if it looks like the association is not uniformly enforcing the covenants, then the defendant has scored a point with the court, and the court is going to look more closely at what it is the association is doing and how it's doing it to determine whether it is arbitrary and capriciously enforcing the covenant they're seeking to enforce against this defendant, which really shifts in part the burden to the association to prove that what they're doing is correct.
So what's the answer, Ken?
Prayer. Prayer has always been the answer.
That was not an answer I was expecting.
Well, even attorneys do it, believe me, and probably more so. The key is that to the extent that the association has those types of provisions in their documents, to the extent that they have any flexibility under them to issue interpretive rulings as to how they interpret that particular covenant, absent that, then what the board should do is attempt to get those archaic, those now what they would consider, I guess, unenforceable provisions in their documents amended out, albeit that it's going to be time-consuming and perhaps somewhat costly and a lot of man-hours and effort put into it to get the requisite number of votes, which is usually some sort of supermajority. The bottom line is, as long as they are in land records, as long as all of the properties within the community are subject to those restrictive covenants, those covenants are of record and should be enforced reasonably, and they are far better off attempting to get the covenants amended than they are just to leave it alone on the books. The other thing is that, you know, if they really communicate with their homeowner members, if they really make the members understand why it is that they need to do this, and let's assume that they fail to do it and they still have that on the books, to the extent that they attempt to enforce it or have to enforce it as they should, in my opinion, the bottom line is that at that point, then the members may at some point down the road realize how important it is to get that amended out so that their association doesn't have to enforce that archaic provision any longer, and that may get them the vote they need. So my suggestion at all times is if there's something on the books that is either not enforceable or that the association cannot enforce, to the extent possible, get that amended off of the books and records of the association's recorded documents by the requisite membership vote so that you protect yourself as an association and the board, not only this board that's sitting now, but also boards in the future, because it's going to come back to bite somebody.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us. Would you believe the hour is over with it?
Well, it's my pleasure. I certainly appreciate the time and the effort that you put into it, too.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule, and I know how hard it's been to reach you. So thank you so much,
Ken. Thank you, and happy holidays to all your listeners.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, happy birthday next week.
Thank you very much.
You weren't expecting that one, were you?
All right.
Okay, thanks to all of you for hanging out on the Commons with us today. Stay tuned, stay free. On the Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See you all next week.